Testing, testing. 1, 2, 3, testing.
House Rules Committee to order.
The date is February 9th. The time is 8:34, and the meeting is taking place in House Chambers. Members present.
Danny Phillips.
Matt O'Connell. Speaker Hayes. Justin Manuel. Chair.
That's right.
I am present for my
correction. The first bill that we're going to pick up is House Bill 229. The sponsor of that bill is Representative Randolph, and he has a committee substitute. I don't see any other members here to testify, so we'll start by Representative Randolph.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Dick Randolph, Representative Fairbanks. House Bill 229 is an attempt to correct the problem that many small businesses have, where they have branch facilities that have a sole person in charge of that facility. State law varies from federal law in that it requires that a person who spends more than 20% of their time in administrative, or who spends less than 20%, people who spend more than 20% of their time in other than administrative or executive duties cannot be paid a salary or a negotiated wage, and have to be paid on an hourly basis. That causes a great many problems, because a lot of these places do in fact have one person on a shift, and one person who manages the store for 24 hours, manages the whole store. But because it's a small operation, they have to
stop
other things. And they determine, they're in sole charge of the situation, so they determine, even after the fact, whether they were spending more or less than 20% of their time doing it. The memo that you have from, so anyway, 229 is an attempt to give additional latitude from state law on that. As far as that provision goes, what 229 does is exactly parallel to federal law on those same types of employees. Now, you have a memo from Dale Chief, which doesn't candidly explain the situation. What federal law does, it allows that a person can only, that the 20% rule applies to all employees except retail service establishment employees and individuals who are in sole charge of the facility. Everything else, if you spend more than 20% of your time doing other than administrative or executive work, you have to be paid on an hourly basis. There are two exceptions to that, and that is the people who work in retail services or people who are in sole charge. The federal law allows the 20% for everybody except those people who work in retail services or in sole charge. Those people who work in retail services can spend, by federal law, can spend 40% of their time doing other than administrative work. And those people who are in sole charge by federal law can spend 100% of their time. So in that regard, and that's what 229 does, in that regard, 229 just puts in compliance with federal law those people who are in sole charge. We're not dealing with other areas at all. Yes.
Representative Randolph, you referred to Dale Cheek's memo of February 8th.
Mm-hmm.
And in section 1, would you care to answer the last bottom of the paragraph? He states that it would render Alaska's law less stringent than the federal law. Would you care to comment on that?
Yeah, in the area I'm dealing with, that's just not an accurate statement. The second sentence in his first paragraph, dealing with it, says the department's definitions are tailored after provisions of the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act. It gives a designation, which also tie eligibility for exemptions to percentage of time spent by the employee performing non-administrative or non-executive duties. That's true, but that's all he says. And what he doesn't say is that the formula I just laid out for you is in fact the case. And right now, you're in a sole charge situation in Alaska. If they spend more than 20% of their time doing other than executive or administrative duties, they have to be paid by hourly wage. By federal law, that's not the case. If you're in sole charge of the facility, you can spend 100% of your time doing other than administrative or official duties and not be some other wage in our qualifications. So his statement is not untrue, but it does not elaborate on what the situation is.
Are there any questions?
There is another part of the bill which may have briefly described, and that's on liquidated damages. Federal law right now provides that the court has flexibility in whether to provide liquidated damages, which is double damages. And it doesn't allow for the good faith exception. Section 2 corrects that problem, and Department of Labor seems to have no problem with that. Section 3 makes it retroactive, and the Department of Labor does seem to have some problem with that. The reason I think the retroactive provision is reasonable, it does not say, if we make this retroactive, that liquidated damages cannot be given. It leaves the discretion up to the court. And if the employer did in fact act in good faith, it seems unfair to have them pay liquidated damages, because our law says that they have to in fact pay liquidated damages. And as of right now, the court does not have the discretion. If there is a case, they have to try to settle for the double jeopardy damages. So if it is good at number two, I mean, if it is fair, then it seems fair to make it apply to different cases. It does not mean that where the employer acted in bad faith, that the court could not allow the liquidated damages. It just gives the court that latitude.
Yeah.
I have just one more thing. I did do a fact sheet, which I hope you all have chance to read. Mr. Chairman, if I do have Steve Dodge, who has worked with me on putting this together, standing by and angry by phone, we could get through this, but he has any more technical questions in this.
Mr. Chairman, could we recess for a few minutes? The privilege of looking over the material that's been put in our folders and since we've had one of
Thank you, Representative Smith. I will, because Representative Malone just laid something on me a few minutes ago. I would like to have copies made for this.
First, let me say that my initial bill and my initial intent was to deal with only Section 1. Section 2 and 3 have been inserted by the State Affairs Committee of their own volition. My intent in introducing the bill was to correct the problem that suggested in Section 1. However, I think Section 2 particularly is exceedingly fair. It does, in fact, parallel, and as the Department of Labor indicates in their memo, federal law. That's the one thing we don't have a problem with. It does not require that liquidated damages cannot be offered. It simply says that if there is a good faith on the employee's part, that he did absolutely nothing negligent, he was just clunking along there doing his thing, then charges are brought. If they win, under state law right now, they have no choice but to give them double damage. There's no question about it. They get it. If they win the case at all, they get their wages plus double. And the court has no jurisdiction in that at all. Neither does the Department of Labor in the negotiating situation. So the employers fight it a lot harder than they would if they could, if they lose the case, they have to pay the guy $5,000 and that's it, but they have to pay him $10,000, which is twice what he has
done. Do they also have to pay the attorney fees if they lose the case?
According to the court, I can't. Yeah.
Well, the thing that I'm confused on is if you get double damages, as I read, rapidly. It looked to me like that was put in there to help the little guy to be able to pay for a lawyer.
I suppose
that I read
well,
it wrong.
I didn't pick it up, but it's very well at the end. I did pick up the little guy thing. I suppose that there might be some sense in there to say that, case up to X amount of dollars maybe make some sense. And you're looking at major settlements like the one the newspaper talked about here, $5 to $15 million. That's certainly any lawyer would take that on a contingency, I'm sure. You can get above any amount. It just seems to me that it's fair to both the employer and employee that if the employer is acting in bad faith, he ought to, you know, suffer consequences. But if he's acting in totally good faith, and in many of these cases, doesn't even have knowledge of what's going on until after the fact, maybe a year or two later, and then people come back and put in any kind of claim. And if they get a positive, if the claimant gets a positive decision, he gets twice what he would have had coming if he just got what he thinks he could have had up front. That does tell us that a lot, that's in compliance with the federal law also.
State affairs, the 5-day notice went out, they had hearings on it. I'm sure that there must have been labor representatives there if they were interested.
They heard the bill 3 different times. I was there once, Randy. I can't answer who was there the other time.
But no response out of it.
I don't know.
Are you proposing an amendment to this committee substitute, Representative Randolph, to take Section 3 out?
I'm convinced it's going to be a very controversial item, probably here in the committee and on the floor, and I think, in fairness, I would recommend it come out.
Mr. Chairman, I was going to offer the amendment to delete Section 3, which is the retroactive provision of this legislation. And I've moved and asked the unanimous consent.
Any objection?
But Jim, I think the other two sections of the bill are highly defensible and highly desirable, and I, you know, urge the committee to pass the bill.
What is the pleasure of the committee, Representative Connor?
I'd just like to explore for a second the immediate effective date. What's the purpose for an immediate and effective date as opposed to, say, the 1st of July or the 1st of January or something, so that any company has a chance to rationally discuss its employment policies before this thing? Now, that may be a totally naive question.
I don't have strong feelings one way or another, and wasn't involved in that decision. The original bill was drafted that way. I suppose they just carried it over to them. I did not provide instructions to drafting or to do that when I asked for the request. I think if it is in fact good law, it's probably, you know, as well to have it take effect to be prompted.
Just another question, Mr. Chairman. Somewhere in this stuff that I just read, it said that, or it addressed the question of attorney's fees for just in case the employee does win the thing. As it reads now, I understand that assuming the employee wins the case, he still has an opportunity for his back wages plus an equal amount of liquidated damages, assuming he can prove that the employer was not operating in good faith.
That's correct.
But does he also have an opportunity for attorney's fees, or is that inherent in the law anyway?
My understanding would be that would be inherent. I think the court always has that latitude.
Mr. Randolph, I'm reading through this stuff too and kind of beginning to ask questions, and they aren't really well formed yet. But I think there's a good point to be made in the attorney's letter that came to Milan, and that's the deterrent factor. And I'm kind of thinking back to that, probably what caused this section to be put in the statute in the first place. There's some notice to employers that there's no, you know, look, don't fool around, just get by it, without any kind of a penalty for them other than having to go to court and hassle through the mouth, which no employees want to do. I know that from having had a good faith effort at building a house where no party wanted to hurt the other, but there is an injured party. And so the difficulty is, how do you go through the hassle of suing for the amount of money that's involved? And yet, the contractor has some real questionable dealings in this. I'm concerned that that's all we're doing, is we're taking away that deterrent factor. And perhaps there's something that we can find that will fill in the deterrent without just having a set of liquidated damages provision of double. I don't think double's necessarily fair, but I don't think it's necessarily a good idea to have an employer to say, I'll see how far I can take it.
Well, I think that you're not recruiting not only employer, but just through negotiations with the Department of Labor. There's an awful lot of cases that would settle, I think, some of the things that the wages owed and the double liquidation, if there was that latitude. And my passion is to do allow that latitude. Where it is now, there's no choice. Department of Labor can't settle these cases. Unless the employer is willing to pay the liquidated damages, which many of them are not, particularly if they're acting in good faith.
Mr. Turner, if I may follow up on that. Do we have any background on the department's workload previous to the passage of the liquidated damages, the removal of the good faith, or?
I don't think it would be very good.
I'm just wondering if the department was complaining about all the effort they were having to make in man hours to deal with such complaints. You know, realizing that it's really easy for somebody to complain and go to the department, if the department's going to do it all for them, and they have no responsibility. I mean, there's a responsibility on the part of the employee as well as the employer.
It seems to me the point is that the potential for liquidated damages is still out. And if the person acts in bad faith, it's going to be part of the payment. But it does, I think, very fairly see both sides in short. And again, I would say that is exactly where the federal law is. If you lack the law, it's not the part of the employer, then it's the federal law.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we strike Section 4. And that would have the effect of just making it effective 90 days from the time the government finds it.
Is that a motion?
Yes.
Yes,
we will.
Any objections?
I move that we move the bill out of committee after unanimous consent.
on this matter.
As a message of reference to committee substitute for House Bill 329 as amended and ruled.
Mr. Chairman, I really can't go along with unanimous consent because I feel like some of the questions I've raised have not been answered. So I want to voice my objection and cast it out before I ever do.
Okay. All in favor of Representative May's motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Aye.
So moved. The next I didn't have to take care of the short term of food mill that strong ended. This is the Senate Concurrent Resolution 34 relating to World Food Day. This resolution was introduced on June 15, 1981, and passed by voice vote on June 16, 1981. It has been in House rules since June 18, 1981. The resolution calls for the governor to designate October 16, 1981 as World Food Day in Alaska, paralleling the designation of October 16th as World Food Day by the United Nations. The reason we are having a hearing on this bill is to amend it to read October 16, 1982 in each state. The United Nations designation is an annual event.
Yes.
Is there any comments on this?
From my understanding, the only thing that's happened here is just changing the date, 1981 to 82.
That is correct.
That's it.
That is the key thing. Any comments by any members of the board? Do I hear a motion?
At the risk of prolonging something here, I really question this whole resolution. You know, is this something that we have to pass? For instance, how do we know that there are literally hundreds of millions of people who have chronic malnutrition? You know?
Just take your hand.
Well, I withdraw my question.
I know it's not a very sexy
issue. Well, you know, what are we encouraging anyway? That this is a dangerous situation, what's the next thing going to be that we share our place with everybody throughout the world?
Which we're doing pretty well right now.
Mm-hmm.
Do I hear a motion on the Senate Concurrent Resolution
34? I'll make the motion to move the Senate Concurrent Resolution 34. Okay, I'll withdraw my original motion and therefore move the two changes in the resolution from 1981 to 1982 to date. And after that, I'll get on the amendment.
Just a quickie, why October 16th? Is that because that's the day of the Russian Revolution?
It's the revolution?
Russian Revolution.
That was November, isn't it?
Any objection?
I'm just going to tell you.
Okay. Representative Phillips, do you
want
to propose
this? Yes, I'll move the Senate Resolution number 34 as amended by the rules. And I'll just ask.
All right.
To move it. Not
all in favor of moving Representative Phillips' motion to the
aye?
All opposed?